Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I'm kind of surprised you didn't know he wrote it.
I'm not a big sci-fi book reader. I'm not a big book reader. In general, I do a lot more magazine and internet reading, but
you're more of an audio Bible kind of guy.
Yeah, the daily Bible with what's his name.
You just have Brandy read the Bible to you while you're smoking your pipe in your chair.
Yes,
a child on each knee.
Yes, thinking deep thoughts, writing books
in front of the fireplace.
We do have a fireplace. We have to start using it.
Oh, cool!
I like y'all. So, yeah,
is it a real fireplace?
It's a real fireplace. A townhouse?
Okay.
Yeah.
For some reason, I was thinking it was an apartment again, but that didn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, did they warn you or anything about the fireplace?
No. Did they explode your apartment?
Yeah.
No, we'll have to get it cleaned, but it's built in, like, 1967, so it's an old school, oldest townhome complex in North Carolina in the state.
Huh. Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we were a little worried because when we had our home inspection done before mm-hmm. we bought the house, we were like, hey, so can we use this fireplace? And the guy was like, oh, you probably want to have like a chimney guy come up. And we were like, but you can't just like, you can't tell. And he's like, no, you can't just like look at it and tell. Mm-hmm. So then I had Laura, I think I looked up a guy and had him come while Laura was here after we moved in, because we moved in right before, actually a little after this time when we moved in.
In November.
And said, like, oh, you know, just go check it out. We want to make sure we can have fireplaces. We don't need you to do anything to it. Just tell us if we can burn fires. And apparently he came and just, like, looked it up and was like, yeah, it's fine.
Really, I can see the sky.
Yeah, it looks good today. Uh-huh. I was like, okay, so you can just come and look up the chimney.
You professional to come say that.
Professional come, yeah. So we paid him, like, 50 or 60 bucks or whatever it costs to have a chimney guy come out. So
mm-hmm.
apparently, anyway, that was surprising to us. Did you have a guy come look at yours?
Not yet.
Are you going to?
Probably.
You don't want to burn down your house?
Some like creosote. Creosote starts building up in there. Then it can catch fire. And
you know the people that had the home before you built fires?
Should have asked them. I don't know.
That was one of the things with ours. They actually had a gas line pumped in through the brick wall.
Wow.
And they had like fake logs in there and stuff. Yeah. And we were like, is this cool? He was like, whatever. They put cement in the hole. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So, as long as, whatever it took, because I wanted fires.
You want real deal fires.
I wanted real deal fires.
I agree completely.
My wife's a big fan of real deal fires.
I feel like gas logs are the cheapest imitation to come along since mm-hmm. margarine.
Just rub your hands over the stove.
Yeah. And what's a gas log?
It doesn't seem like it fills the room with heat. I just feel like it always, you know, it's just kind of like it's like a space heater.
Yeah.
Like you never really get warm. Just kind of looks nice in the background.
Yeah.
Plus, you don't get all these nice burn marks in your carpet from.
Oh yeah.
Embers that jump out. You don't ever have the fear of catching fire in your home. You know.
Stupid gas logs. No danger there.
Yeah.
No adventure.
Live on the edge.
Yeah, risk. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
That's where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone over most everything in prep for the show, so I'm assuming that you're ready.
I guess so.
You sound reticent.
You always act this way, though, and you're always like
the
best.
She like, I don't know, rocks it.
Both times I felt more prepared than I do for this
one. Well, both times you knocked it out of the park, so there you go.
Now so, I got a standard to uphold.
This will be an in park comment, right?
Exactly. Let's keep it in.
We're just going to be sitting here listening to you.
That's the safe thing to do, actually. I'm just going to ask lots of questions. No opinions here.
I have no thoughts.
I have no opinions about women and their views of sex.
Zero. None. Yeah. I stopped talking a long time ago. Yeah. Okay, but you're ready.
Yes.
Okay, and you're ready.
I'm ready.
All right, cool. Well, since everyone is ready, welcome to Real World Theology, Episode 11. I'm your host, Fizz. This week, we return to the realm of new releases and take a look at the thought-provoking independent film from Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Don John. The film is about a New Jersey guy dedicated to his family, his friends, and his church, who develops unrealistic expectations from watching pornography and works to find happiness and intimacy with his potential true love. My guests today are writer, blogger, and the love of my life, Laura Fissel, accompanied by the community pastor of Church of the Redeemer in Greensboro, Elijah Don Juan Lovejoy. So welcome.
I thought I was the love of your life. What's going on here? I can't be the love of your life too.
Can you have multiple loves of my life?
Sure.
Are you sure?
Not in the same way, but yeah. David loved Jonathan like a brother.
So you want to be my Jonathan?
Sure.
And she's Jonathan. My one of the ones that I had.
Put me in a different category.
With.
Yeah.
Well. All right, so like we said, we're gonna cover Don John. This movie is quite audacious for a first-time filmmaker. We have grown to really enjoy Joseph Gordon-Levitt from his roles in movies and TV like Third Rock from the Sun, 500 Days of Summer, Inception, The Dark Knight Rises, and Looper. But now he takes the next step as an artist by writing and directing and starring in his first feature film. We see actors making this transition all the time, but usually not with such a raw topic and usually not in such an in-your-face way. And it deserves to be said that though this film is very discussion-worthy, it does deal with issues of masturbation, pornography, addiction, and sexual themes in very frank ways that anyone wanting to see this film who has not yet should use a lot of discretion in doing so. So I'm going to put that out there. But with that disclaimer, everyone here on the panel has seen the film, for better or for worse, and have been gathering their thoughts in what will be one of our more intentional discussions that we've had on the podcast. Addiction, pornography, romance, love, and where the church fits into all of that. All up for grabs. So with that, we start like we usually do. Did you enjoy the movie? First thoughts. So... Elijah, just what were your thoughts on the movie?
As a movie, I found the movie extremely fast-paced. The cinematography, It was very clippy. I might be exaggerating a little bit, but I'm not sure any scene went over like 30 seconds and before it just cut to another scene. So it felt very fast. Overall, I think the movie is a great conversation starter, raised a lot of great issues. By the way, my fear coming out of this podcast is that the subtitle is going to be Pastor Recommends Porn Movie. So I need to clarify at the beginning, I actually wouldn't recommend the movie unless you're addicted to pornography. Then I think the movie is very helpful because it helps raise questions and think through that. So I enjoyed the movie as a conversation starter. It was very raw and I wouldn't go see it again, but it provoked a lot of gospel connections for me, which I'll share later. But a lot of gospel connections from seeing the movie.
I mean, did you, like, you know, I'm not, we don't really give star ratings, but I mean, like, did you think it was a well-done film?
It was a well-done film. As films go, yes, I thought it was a very well-done film. And I agree with what you said that I admire him for tackling this topic. Like, he tackles it in a very raw way, which gives him authenticity as a movie maker and as an actor. And I admire him for doing it because he doesn't portray pornography in a flattering light. Like he actually portrays some of the consequences of pornography, which I think is rare and admirable.
Okay, cool. Laura?
Yes, I did. I think particularly because it doesn't let anyone off the hook. There are a lot of, this is not really just about pornography, although that is the centerpiece. So there's a lot of other addiction and a lot of other cultural norms that are called into question that I feel like his parents, his sister, his friends, his girlfriend, everyone has something that he asks questions about with this film. So I appreciated that about it. And it was humorous, which is really good, I think, in tackling this subject. In one of the articles that you sent out, one of the writers compared it thematically to the movie Shame, which was not in any way humorous. That was a really hard film to watch.
Have you seen Shame, Elijah?
No.
Okay.
And I felt like I felt like just the tone of the film helped you enter in a little bit better than Shame. It was a little bit more accessible, I guess. And so therefore the themes were a little bit more accessible. So I did enjoy it. I thought it was good storytelling, good writing, good acting.
And I would add one thing, one thought about the movie, just from a kind of general pastor's perspective. So one of my main callings and responsibilities is to seek people's spiritual edification, particularly in a Christian context. Mm-hmm. And so it intrigues me that a movie can be edifying or not, depending on where the cultural conversation starts.
Mm-hmm.
So that movie in 20 years might be one of the most clean movies that comes out, depending on where the culture goes. Mm-hmm. And 20 years back or 50 years back or whatever, that movie would have been a shocker. And so when I recommend or don't recommend the movie, it's kind of based on where you're starting in your level of edification. And so if you're mm-hmm. starting at a fairly low place in terms of your sexual health, then I would recommend this movie because it's going to help you grow a little bit. But if you're not addicted to pornography and have a relatively healthy view of men or women, depending on which side you're coming from, then I'm not sure the movie would be particularly helpful in terms of the edifying department. Mm-hmm. So that's my standard based on which I would recommend or not recommend the movie.
Yeah, I want to say that I also did really enjoy the movie from just a filmmaking perspective. I was even more blown away, I guess, because it was, Joseph Gordon-Levitt has, you can look it up on IMDb. He's done some short mm-hmm. films, written a little bit, done a little bit of directorial stuff, but this is his first feature length film. He didn't go somewhere and like make a movie for like $50 million
mm-hmm.
and have all these big names producing it and stuff like that. He made a movie, I think it only cost him like $6 million to make, which in Hollywood terms does kind of make it an independent film. So to have this much success, to make something this good mm-hmm. that on one hand isn't a blockbuster, but still has enough blockbuster appeal mm-hmm. to the masses to kind of make that next level, I think that's a very fine line, and very few things can do that.
Yeah.
The only kind of movies that you typically see with that kind of return on investment are like fairly cheap horror movies, lots mm-hmm. of night vision, you know, not real special effects to speak of. They're the ones that, you know, you spend $11 million and you make $110 million around Halloween or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him to do that, especially in a summer, especially in a year where so many movies are not making their budgets and mm-hmm. not telling stories worth really watching, mm-hmm. that was even more impressive to me.
Mm-hmm.
So you take all that, you take it's his first movie, he took on, you know, three hats of writing, directing, and starring in. So he also had to make sacrifices to actually be able to play this character mm-hmm. that he'd written. Very impressive. The subject matter was very raw. It hit home in a lot of places. I mean, I don't think it pulled any punches. I don't think it tried to pull any punches.
Mm-hmm.
And like Laura pointed out already, I think one of the best parts about it is, unlike a movie like Shame, which were basically, actually, even to a greater extent, I wouldn't really necessarily recommend to people, even though I think it's a really well-done movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's very heavy mm-hmm. and really difficult to watch because it deals with addiction in such a gritty and dark way
mm-hmm.
that if you're not actually going through that, I can't imagine it's really helpful to watch it at all. This has the humor. It makes it a little more accessible, whether you're actually necessarily going through that or not. So lots of reasons. I really enjoyed this film. Unfortunately, it falls under that very slim category where it can be one of the top films that I've seen all year, but I have no real desire to own this on DVD
mm-hmm.
or Blu-ray or, you know, whatever the kids are watching these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really need to see it again. I don't really necessarily want to see it again. But I think, you know, it was worth seeing once, especially if you are into film and things that are done well.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, I want to kind of piggyback off something Laura said again to kind of start our conversation. And one of the things that really hit me, that really struck me, I guess, when I left, was advertising for this movie really showed it as a guy who was struggling with pornography addiction. But after watching the film, I realized that whether he meant it to or not, it was basically an entire cast of characters all struggling with their own addictions that were kind of equally as deadly and life-altering, except there was only one that was really technicolor, for lack of a better term. You know, all these other ones are fairly socially acceptable. If you look at every single character in the movie, I mean, John himself, he does struggle with pornography, but his dad was obviously addicted to sports. Mm-hmm. His mom was addicted to some kind of, like, the need for family. That's all she ever wanted to talk about. So, you know, she didn't really care about how he was doing as a son. She had this other thing or that she wanted. Barbara, she ends up being a pretty big addict too. And it's actually pointed out in the film the false romance. His shorter friend, I don't remember what either the guy's names were, but the shorter friend was obviously addicted to alcohol. He obviously had some alcohol problems.
I know the other one's name was Bobby.
So we're so close. Did you feel like it tried to represent addiction as a whole, or do you think Joseph Gordon-Levitt understood what he was doing?
Yeah, I do. I mean, he had an interview, I think it was with NPR, where he talked about said there's not a lot of difference between a lot of mainstream culture and pornography. They're equally simplistic and equally reductionist. That's a pretty bold statement to compare mainstream culture and pornography. I do think that the movie represents multiple addictions. I would also say I don't think all addictions are created equally. I don't think any addiction's good. But I do think there are more destructive addictions than others. So the mom being addicted to wanting grandkids, I wouldn't necessarily put that on par with Don John having to masturbate or do his thing 10 or 11 times a day and hit his goal. So yeah, I would say, yes, definitely talking to addictions more broadly. And I think that's also a savvy move marketing-wise on Joseph Gordon-Levitt's part. If he got pigeonholed as an anti-porn movie, then it kind of sets him at odds with the pornography industry, which is a pretty big industry, and it makes it more of a moralistic movie, whereas if he's criticizing addiction more broadly, he's speaking to a broader audience.
I guess I'm not entirely convinced that it's about addiction per se. I feel like maybe it's more about cultural perceptions about gender roles and about sexuality in general. Because I was thinking about how, I mean, it's not necessarily easy for John to come out of that addiction at the end of the film, but he does. I don't want to say that it's easy, but we don't really see the kind of struggle that you see in Shame, for example, where basically that to me, it always reminds me of the Lord of the Rings, actually, when Frodo is standing over the fires of Mount Doom holding the ring and he can't let go of it. That to me is a picture of true addiction, is when you cannot let go. You know, you have every opportunity to turn away from it and you do not have it in you to let go of that. And I feel like that was the picture of addiction and shame. But here it feels like when John is shown a better way, or when he sees that there are rewards, or that it feels better to do something another way, that he moves into that and he's able to leave it behind. And so I was just kind of thinking about, in terms of somebody who's really struggling with addiction and cannot get out of it on their own, if they see this film and they watch that, what is their perception of that going to be? That the movie is saying, oh, it's so easy if you just know that, you know, that it's better this other way, you know, that life is better this other way, relationships are better. So I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily about addiction, but maybe it's just because that seems to me a really harsh word to use for it. I don't know.
Well, I think it doesn't really show. He doesn't even believe or agree that he has an addiction till like the end of the movie. So I think maybe it's depicting addiction, but I mean, to put it personally, how often do we just live our life being happy with our little addictions, and we don't even call them addictions or recognize them as addictions? So mm-hmm. I don't think the movie's showing the struggle of addiction. I think it's more of a comedy about addiction than, from what I understand of Shame, kind of a raw, gritty, like gut-wrenching type depiction of addiction. And so in that sense, it's not naming it as addiction, but I think it is pretty clearly showing that we all get caught up in the patterns of our life, the things that we just have to have, can't do without. Like if you've taken the phone away from his younger sister, like she probably would have freaked out and gotten mad at you. So what's going on there? So yeah, I think I hear the difference that you're describing. I think the subject matter is similar, but the perception of it from the point of view of the characters, one's realizing it apparently in Shame, and one's, all the ones in this movie are pretty much oblivious to their addiction, I think.
Well, I want to not completely disagree, but challenge something you said a little bit earlier, Elijah. You said that addictions do have kind of different levels. You know, they're not all created equal. And I think maybe according to this movie, they might be. I want to say that it's possible, because this is all just like a, you know, reading and, you know, interpreting it. I didn't call, you know, JGL up on the phone and ask him. But what I saw was there's culturally acceptable addictions, and then there's non-culturally acceptable addictions, or addictions. And, you know, being addicted to sports is culturally acceptable. It's actually culturally encouraged. Wanting to have grandkids and being obsessed with, you know, procreation is pretty accepted. I mean, especially in the Christian subculture. But both of those things have the same result that John's addiction to pornography has. His addiction to pornography does not let him see reality, and it does not let him have a connection with another person. And sports keeps his father from having a relationship with him. And his mother's only interest in if he's going to give her grandkids prevents her from ever asking any questions about how he's actually doing. They just see him as like an end, you know, a means to an end, and or something that comes over for dinner. Not like a true parent-child connection. I mean, you know, alcohol keeps the other guy from ever seeing like women as something that he could actually be with long-term. The daughter doesn't really typically ever get involved. She's the only person somehow who sees, you know, that John's not being treated like a person by a whole bunch of people. But it's, it has the same kind of result. So, I mean, like I said, I wouldn't necessarily disagree, because I think there are more destructive addictions. But I feel like this movie portrayed in a very subtle, non-said way.
Similar effects.
Similar effects to addictions.
You know? I'd buy that,
Well, it definitely is challenging the perception that some things are acceptable and some things aren't. I mean, there's one scene, I was writing notes in the theater while I watched, and there was a scene when it was in the middle of, like, Barbara and John's relationship, and he basically was narrating and saying something like, he's not allowed to, you know, he's not doing his addiction. But while he's talking about it, it's showing her at his house watching a romantic comedy with him. And her expression is purposefully very similar to somebody who's having a sexual experience. So it feels like, well, she's allowed to have her addiction, you know, around him or do it in front of him, and he can't do his. So I think it is definitely doing what you say, challenging that some are seen as acceptable and some aren't, but that they are destructive. But I wonder if it's not just the thing, the idol or whatever, the addiction that is, that causes different levels of destruction, but it's the person coming into it. How much are they of themselves are they giving to it? What are they allowing it to control in their lives? So maybe it's, you know, and everyone has different reasons for being involved in that addiction. Like the sister, when she's on her phone all the time, it just makes me think, well, there's just nothing else interesting to her. There's nothing else compelling to her out there. And so she's turning to that, not because she can't necessarily give it up. She's addicted to it in that way, but that there's, I don't know, she's just falling into it because there's nothing else out there that's, you know, more interesting or more, you know, Yeah.
I think that's good. You're actually getting into the how do you define an addiction? I mean, if somebody eats three times a day and they do that regularly, is that an addiction or is that more of a cultural custom? Mm-hmm. So I think I think that is getting into, I guess, more of a way to assess whether something is an addiction or not. Here's something that intrigues me. I'm going to give you a hypothetical. So, if a person, let's just take a random person.
But am I going to incriminate myself in one way or the other by answering whatever this hypothetical situation is?
No, it's rhetorical.
Okay.
So you're off the hook. You're off the hook. So if a person, a generic person, required you to sit and watch them all day, if they required you to visit 46 websites, if they didn't allow you to talk to any of your friends or answer the phone when your friends were calling, if they wouldn't let you focus on your girlfriend when you were trying to have a conversation with your girlfriend, if they made you lie anytime their name came up, and like they were insistent about this, they didn't let you have any other way, would you consider that a form of slavery?
Hmm. Are you talking about my imaginary friend, Steve?
Yeah, I'm talking about your imaginary friend. So I think what I saw was, if a person did what porn required Don John to do, it would be considered oppressive and manipulative and enslaving.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was porn doing it, it was like, hey, I mean, I'm free. So because
it was a choice.
Yeah, it was
the appearance of choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the appearance of choice. So the aphorism or the axiom that hits me is, the sin promises life on the front end and death on the back end. And so it makes the choice look good or appealing or freeing. And we'll get to this later, but just a teaser maybe. Jesus promises death on the front end and life on the back end. Mm-hmm. So what sin promises and what Jesus promises are actually exact opposites. And the results are the exact opposite as well. But going to the addiction thing, if you replaced what porn was doing to him with a person doing that to him, be like, get out of my face. I want to be able to answer the phone. I want to be able to talk to my girlfriend without you constantly interrupting me with flashing images of yourself, which is a scene in the movie. So he's obviously enslaved to something, even though he doesn't really realize that.
Well, we've kind of already hit on this already. And so I just want to, I guess, transition into it, but I kind of want to address, and this is why Laura is here, because it's not going to be two guys or three guys talking about how women think and feel. So I kind of wanted to talk about almost like the cultural impact of pornography and then the expanded definition of pornography, porn for women, or what I think lots of us guys kind of joke about is HGTV, you know, the Home Garden Network, the porn for women. depending on your cultural saturation, the Home Shopping Network, the romantic, unrealistic romantic comedies, the things that Barbara in the movie describes. Like, as a woman, which you are, like, does that ever cross your mind from a cultural standpoint? Do you ever think that, like, I'm being sold a bill of goods, or I'm being enslaved to the things that I want, even though it's culturally acceptable?
That's a hard question for me to answer because I don't necessarily like those things that you mentioned. I think that's such a stereotype.
Well, it is.
Yeah.
But surely, well, I guess there's a concept that men want sex and women want security. And that's what they want, the promise of security. They want the promise that they're going to be loved unconditionally, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but maybe in means that are unrealistic. Like, do you ever stop yourself from watching like a romantic comedy? I mean, when you watch Pride and Prejudice, is it like, does it do it for you?
It depends on what you mean by that. I'm not sure I want you to be explicit there. I think it makes it more difficult to, I think you have to be more aware of that to be able to notice it when you're watching something like that, just because it's not as technicolor, to use your term, because it's not as obvious, and because no one's going to say, I can't believe you're sitting there watching that. Like, how dare you? You should feel ashamed.
For when you're like, well, Mr. Darcy wouldn't have said that to me, giving you unrealistic expectations.
I mean, I will say, okay, there was one instance comes to mind when you and I were watching Friday Night Lights. We're going through Friday Night Lights. And one of the things I love about that show is the marriage between Coach and Tammy, and just how honest it is. And I remember having a conversation with my good friend Mary, where I was saying something and I didn't even realize it, but I said something about, like, I compared the way that Coach did something in their marriage to, like, oh, I wish Mikey would just have done this or could just be this way, you know? And Mary was like, well, that's fictional. And I was like, that's right. That's right. That's fictional. So I think it does kind of get into your brain in ways that you may not realize it. But I don't know if this is really a specific question even for me as a woman in this group, though, because I feel like what you're talking about is going to be anything in anybody, any gender's life that is an unreality, that is like a fantasy of what they want it to be, that it's not going to be. So, I mean, that's true of, I mean, isn't that true of, couldn't that be true of sports in a way that is socially acceptable?
Sports are completely fine.
Not football. Maybe other sports.
Maybe other sports.
But not football.
People who are really into, like, hockey, that's totally an addiction.
I think I would add to your earlier teasing out a definition of addiction. I don't think you can talk about addiction without talking about moral foundations. And so I think you evaluate an addiction, or you call something addiction, which I would use the word enslavement, based on whether, from a Christian point of view, whether it violates God's law. And so if something's enslaving you to disobey God, it's an addiction. If you're a slave to Christ, then it's not an addiction. Like, you're actually supposed to be a slave to Christ. Mm-hmm. And so that's a good thing. So I think it gets morally confusing to call everything that you do habitually an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's like, well, okay, yeah. Then what's an addiction? If everything's an addiction, then what's an addiction?
I'm addicted to going to work because I like to.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be the same for everybody. I mean, sure. Like, for example, I could watch Pride and Prejudice and not feel like, oh, you know, I hate my life because it doesn't look like this. And kind of displace myself from my life so that I'm only thinking about it in terms of wanting it to be like that. But maybe some women can't do that. I mean, it's possible that that's destructive for some women. And there are things that I watch or do that probably are the same, you know. So
Battlestar Galactica, I understand.
Yeah, you know, all those science fiction things. So yeah, I agree, Elijah, that you have to have some kind of standard that you're
right,
that you're basing your definition off of, and we all happen to have the same standard or similar.
Right. I think the movie has a great phrase for it when it talks about, when he says, I can lose myself. It says, why is porn, he says, porn sex is better than real sex. And I think it's Julianne Moore's character, Esther, asks him why. He says, because I can lose myself in porn sex. And so I think an addiction, one definition of an addiction is losing yourself in something that is not worthy of being lost in. Like, you're giving too much of yourself, and it's not going to reciprocate, and you shouldn't expect it to reciprocate. And I this is actually where I see one of the biggest connections to the gospel right here is So sin invites you, sin in the form of just pornography as an example of sin, invites you to lose yourself in it and promises you life, but gives you death. Mm-hmm. So Luke 9, Jesus actually invites us to lose ourselves in him, which is almost the exact same language that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is using in this movie, quite interestingly. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. So I think one of the things, not getting too specifically into the church comments on sexuality, but just the church, I think the church has presented the Christian faith as loss and nothing found. Like, they present the, yeah, you can't do that, you gotta die with Jesus, mm-hmm. but they don't present the life on the back end, whereas sin does such a good job of presenting the life on the front end that, yeah, of course, culturally, I want that every time over everything I'm gonna have to give up. So the cultural perception of following Christ is, I don't want to have to give this up and that up and that up. It's everything I'm going to lose. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we as Christians have done a very good job of proclaiming and depicting what you actually, the joy, what you say, what you find on the back end of dying with Jesus. Mm-hmm. So just the whole concept of losing yourself in something, I think, is a huge entry point to the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like where you're going with that, because I do want to talk about the role of the church in the movie. And there's a quote that I really liked, sadly, from one of the blogs that I had you guys read, and it said, "No wonder so many young, well-meaning people, just like John, don't take the church's beliefs about our bodies seriously. The church doesn't take itself seriously enough to warrant attention." Mm-hmm. And you know, we see him going in there, you know, week after week, confessing and hoping that there is some kind of moral compass, you know, that he's getting better, that he's doing better. Mm-hmm. That he kind of knows what's right and wrong because something's telling him, because something's invested in him. But actually, it's another situation where he has a relationship, something just like his parents, just like Barbara, mm-hmm. but it's not investing back. Mm. You know, it's not a two-way street. So when you talk about the church doing a bad job of kind of showing the life on the back end, like, do you see the way that the church was portrayed in this film as far off? I mean, from probably, especially cultural understanding of it? Defender of the faith?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, one of the interviewers in an article you linked us to was asked a similar question, and he was hesitant to speak for the whole church.
Yeah.
So I'd say I'm hesitant to speak for the whole church, but I'll speak to for how the church was portrayed in this movie.
Yeah.
And I do think, so if you haven't watched the movie, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he does his sinning all week. He describes how many times he's watched porn and how many times he's masturbated while he's watching porn. He confesses that in the confession box to the priest who's sitting right next to him. And then the priest says, I think basically, 10 Our Fathers and 15 Hail Marys, like, gives him kind of like a prescription, like, take this prescription. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt either gets excited because it's a little less than the previous week, or he gets boned because he screwed up more, no pun intended, during the week. And
pun intended.
Oh, yeah.
pun intended. And so he's got more Our Fathers and Hail Marys. And then he goes to the gym and he does his Our Fathers, which is my favorite, one of my favorite scenes. So he does the Our Fathers and the Hail Marys while he's working out. So he's gritting his teeth, lifting weights. Our Father, who art in heaven. He's pumping iron and doing his Our Fathers. And so that depiction to me is incomplete and shallow, because it's not calling him to true discipleship. So what the priest should have said, I think, is, son, you're losing yourself in porn, and what Jesus wants is for you to lose yourself in him. And the way you do that is by taking up your cross, verse right before this, you take up your cross and you die daily. That's what you're called to do. And when you do that, you're going to get to rise with Jesus, and you're going to get to experience life like you've never seen it before, because that's, because Jesus' resurrection is inevitable. Nothing could keep him in the ground. So he should have called him to the person of Christ, and specifically to die and rise with Jesus. Instead, he just kind of gave him an assignment, mm-hmm. which you could say was intended to point him to Jesus, but that's clearly not how he was taking it.
Mm-hmm. Another one of the, this may have been the same site that you directed us to, Zeke Film, I think it's called. He basically says that. He says, for too often the church has seen these things as lifestyle management issues and has largely been guilty of calling out the problems of objectification and the like without providing the life-changing narrative of hope and transformation offered in the scriptures. So John begins to change when he sees that there's actually something better out there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that could have been offered in that place in church, because he clearly was seeking something there. I mean, he wanted his prescription to be less. He was so excited when he you know, was doing better. You know,
and it was on his original list of things that were important to him.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
for some reason. There.
Yeah. So, and actually, I know some places in the scripture that I could go if I wanted to research this, but I didn't do that before tonight, and I was thinking about that concept of how the church is so often seen as an institution and wants to tell you how to clean up your behavior, specifically focused on behavior and nothing else. And I was trying to think about the things that I've been in church my whole life. And so I feel like I should know, right, what the Bible says or what God says about sex. But the things that immediately come to mind are, you're not supposed to have sex outside of marriage. If you can't control yourself, Paul says, you better just get married, you know? I mean, these are the things that I can't really think of anything off the top of my head where the Bible is talking about life being found in that place. Hmm. Not because it's not there, but because the things that have been spoken about in church or between Christians in my life, for some reason, have all been negative, putting sex in a negative light.
Right. You didn't read the Song of Solomon?
Well, a lot of Christians don't know what to do with it, so they kind of pretend it's not there, or that it's all a poem.
Well, we never saw exactly what Esther gave John when she was trying to give him classier pornography. Maybe it was just a copy of the Song of Solomon. she's like, oh, you'll love this. It's very classy.
Yeah, and I think her name is significant.
Oh yeah,
I think. Because I mean, the way I've heard Esther described in kind of a humorous way is she's the one that impressed the king with her sexual abilities more than anybody else, right? That's what he was looking for. Mm-hmm. He was looking for the best concubine he could find, and she, a daughter of Israel, got the job.
Yeah,
and so a lot of commentators would say that's kind of a picture of how far down the spiral Israel had gone. Like, the name of God is not mentioned once in the book of Esther, so it almost didn't make it into the canon of scripture, because there was a huge debate over whether it should be included. But still, Esther and Mordecai, God uses them to save the Jews in that day, and so God was being merciful. So anyway, seeing Julianne Moore's character named Esther, I just see tons of parallels with, like, she was the one who won Don John's heart, and none of the other girls were able to do that. And I do think he found in her a next best thing. Like, he found in her a gift from God. Like, Proverbs talks about he who finds a wife finds a gift from the Lord, finds a good thing. So he found satisfaction in her. He didn't find it in Christ or in the church, which is ultimately, it's going to become a form of idolatry to find satisfaction in God's creation instead of in God himself. But it's still a good thing that God created. It's just not the best thing,
the ultimate
thing. Mm-hmm. One other connection here. So how I would say, rearticulate what you were saying earlier, I think the church does a good job of emphasizing the can't do's, but does a poor job of emphasizing the can do's. Mm-hmm. So we say, stay away from that, stay away from that, stay away from that. Probably because we're scared of sin, or we're scared of seeing stuff go off the cliff. Which, by the way, the New Testament talks about this stuff a ton. So apparently this was a big problem in the early church, right? I mean, sleeping with your mother-in-law, yeah. and don't go to the temple and have sex with the prostitutes. That's a no-no. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the Christians, this movie is very relevant. And
it's like modern laws. You wonder why there's like laws that say you can't do like these ridiculous things, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't have to make the law if someone hadn't done it.
Hadn't done the ridiculous thing. So I think one of the things that church, I guess I'll just speak for myself personally. Like I know how I'm not supposed to treat or see a woman, who I'm not married to, is not my wife. I don't know how I am supposed to see. Oftentimes, I don't know how I am supposed to see or treat a woman who I'm not married to, and who's not my wife. And the best passage is that speaks to this is 1 Timothy 5:1-2. It says, "Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity." So I think what the church would do well to start emphasizing a lot is look at all women as your sister. Like, treat them as you would a sister. And then, hey, if God, like, opens the door and it becomes a step further, I mean, don't take this too literally, but you become more than a figurative sister. Like, they become your wife, yeah. which is an exciting thing. But I think that would radicalize male-female relationships if we started from the place of brother, sister, instead of starting from the place of objectification and like, mm-hmm. I'm going to rate you on a scale of 1 to 10, and then I'm going to decide how quickly I can get you in bed with me. Like, mm-hmm. brother and sister is where I think there's room to grow.
As long as you don't bring that scripture up if we ever do Star Wars. When we're talking about Luke Skywalker, how he treats his sister.
Does he not treat her well?
Have you not seen Star Wars?
Not since I was 5.
Oh, man. Luke kisses his sister.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Remember before he has his sister?
Oh, yeah. But he didn't know it was his sister. So he's got a loophole.
So that's okay.
He's got a loophole there. Yeah. He complete ignorance.
All right. Let me make some notes. Do not ask Elijah to help review Star Wars.
Yeah, no.
You know, it's interesting. I'm just thinking about this concept of how we treat other people of the opposite gender. And there were a lot of clips of porn in this movie that I know why it was there. And I think the movie was very purposeful in everything that it did. And I don't necessarily want to see those images, but it wasn't those things that horrified me. I guess that's a really strong word, but the thing that really bothered me the most is when they were in the club and they were talking about girls, and they were not just rating the girl overall, but they were rating different parts of her body. Mm-hmm. And that bothered me more. I don't know. I would love to talk a little bit about all the cultural influences that led to John's behavior. Because I know ultimately he has a choice and he's making choices, and so is everybody else. But I can't help but look at his family dinners and look at his interactions with his father and feel like there aren't other factors involved there.
Right. And he says earlier in the movie, like, they have a conversation about when he started watching porn. And he said, I don't know, like, when I was in middle school, I started mm-hmm. looking at magazines. And so mm-hmm. it really is. He definitely portrays a history there.
And the only time that I think that they ever showed a connection between father and son was when they were mm-hmm. both oogling his girlfriend, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
When he was, I mean, even to the point of his dad is having her bend over in front of him. And, you know, mm-hmm. they're connecting over the hotness of this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the only time that they're not angry and fighting at each other. Right. Either that, or there's one other moment where they're watching an actual Hardee's commercial that's on between the football game.
Or Carl's Jr., for those of you on the West Coast.
Yes, or Carl's Jr. Mm-hmm. And that's the other time where they're both focused on one thing, and they're mm-hmm. both kind of in it together.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, they're pretty much at each other's throat all the time.
Mm-hmm. You got to be better than that, Tony Danza. We expect more from you.
Well, and the thing we haven't got to that relates to that is his anger problem. Like, every time he's driving mm-hmm. a car, he's just ticked off. He's impatient. He's yelling. There's kind of a desire for immediate gratification and mm-hmm. he wants to get where he's going. But when you were talking, I just started wondering, like, he defends pornography and he doesn't see it as an addiction, and yet he still confesses it every Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an odd kind of disconnect for me. Like,
I thought about that too. And also when he says, he actually says the phrase, "I don't know what's wrong with me," to you, Esther, I think, when they're in her Jeep.
Yeah.
So he clearly sees that it's wrong, that there's right. something wrong with that. But
and Barbara Sugarman, when she leaves him, says,
"You're disgusting."
No, she says, she says, "You're no different than the rest of them. There's nothing different about you." Like, she just lumps him in. So it kind of gets to this idea of he can't change, or he hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And so there's like this impotence of confessing and this lack of change. This is a confession, but then the impotence of not changing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you talk about that as much as you wanted to?
I don't really know if there's, I don't know how much there is to talk about it. I guess I'm wondering how much of the onus can we put on our cultural influences? Hmm. Barbara, there's a very odd scene where Barbara gets really angry at John because he is cleaning his own apartment. Hmm. And that just shocks and horrifies her because he's not supposed to be cleaning. That's embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is clearly comes from her family background because she doesn't even clean. It's... Hmm. They have a cleaning lady, and she says she'll send over her cleaning lady. And she says at the very end of the movie something like, I think I wrote down part of the quote, when he's actually trying to make amends with her and trying to confess to her, she says, "Well, when a real man loves a woman," she uses the words "real man." So she's got a concept that came from somewhere about what a real man is and what they're supposed to do. Mm. So I don't know. I guess I'm wondering, can we say that some of the responsibility is on our upbringing? I don't know. On what the culture is showing us, you know, that Hardee's commercial is out there for everyone to see. I feel the same way about Victoria's Secret commercials. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't really want to see this, and I don't really want my husband to see it. You know, I don't know. There's just so much out there that feels like it's out of our control. So how much control do we have? How much responsibility do we have for those things being in our lives?
I mean, it clearly seems to be escalating. I think, Mikey, you might have seen the article link about the study that was done in Britain where they brought 10 or 12 people that they knew were addicted to pornography and 10 or 12 people that they knew weren't addicted to pornography. And separately, they showed them each images of pornography, and the people who weren't addicted, it just... And they were had specifically studying what happened in their brain physiologically when they saw the images. And the people that were addicted had the same chemical reaction in whatever part of your brain registers addictive reaction as they would as a drug addict would. And the people who weren't addicted didn't have the same reaction or part of their brain lighting up. So the conclusion of this article, I was in the Daily Mail in Britain, was that to have unregulated access to pornography for kids is like leaving heroin needles sitting around playgrounds. Mm. And apparently this is way more of a problem in Britain. Like, David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, is addressing this publicly. It's mm-hmm. such a big issue over there. But yeah, so I think with the ubiquity of smartphones and iPads, one statistic I read earlier said that 1 in 5 mobile searches is a search for porn. So mm-hmm. when you have your phone with you at all times, to your cultural point, it's going to be harder and harder to not come in contact with technology that is always around you. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately going to shape. And I don't know if this is where you're going with it, but so the question that comes to my mind is, how does change happen? How do you reverse the trajectory?
What can you do about that?
Yeah, what can you do? And I don't know, Mikey, what can we do?
Well, I think that leads to one of the last things I want to make sure we covered, which is this, the idea that the film gives us.
Yeah.
I guess, hypothetically, the idea that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's giving us. And that's... that this self-sacrificial love, as Esther puts it, if you want to lose yourself, You have to lose yourself in another person. And she has to lose herself in you. It's a two-way thing. And we address all addictions. And I think this would be to a certain degree true. I mean, I think it's what you've been describing earlier, that we do need to lose ourselves, not to a thing,
right?
Not to pornography, not to sports, right? Not to romantic comedies, not to HGTV, but to a person.
Right.
But that person would be Christ. Mm-hmm. But that's where I'm wondering kind of what this, where this movie leaves us. I actually was reminded a lot when I heard that of the podcast we did last week on Serenity. There's a, like, there's a very empty, you know, just believe in something.
Right.
And I feel kind of like that's where this movie left us. Just like, lose yourself in another person. As long as it's another person, it's better than
right
being somewhere else. And I just don't feel like that really, for a movie that was honest and kind of in your face, I feel like it didn't leave me with something that I can really hold on to.
Yeah, I mean, that's where he started off in a better spot than where he left off. So that's where the whole edifying screwed upness thing is all relative. So if you start off like being a mass murderer and you become just an assassin, then it's a redemptive movie. Oh my goodness. Like, how wonderful. And so he definitely starts off.
Can you describe Wolverine?
Okay. Then, so I think he starts off in a better place than he was. I wouldn't describe it as a great place just because he's still not, he still hasn't seen the fullness of redemption. I go back to the question, what does it look like to lose yourself in Christ? So this movie gave us a pretty honest depiction of what it looks like to lose yourself in pornography, right?
Mm-hmm.
46 websites, 10 times a day, can't answer the phone, can't have a clear conversation, constantly needing to be there. You got your rhythm and your routine down. And so what would it look like to not to have a non-cheesy, non-trivial, non- trite, non-rote depiction of losing yourself in Christ? And the example that comes to my mind is the martyrdom of early Christians when they would be taken to the Colosseum and fed to the lions. One of the things that the church historians have said that turned the culture closer to Christianity is people couldn't believe the peace and the joy on early Christians' faces as they were being devoured by the animals. Like, and some stories in Eusebius actually kind of describe this radiance coming off of the person. And so it's like, what in the world has that person lost themselves in so that being eaten by a lion is actually a non-fearful and even almost joyous thing? Like, there must be something amazing. And so I think it helps for the culture to see depicted in us, not in a preachy way or a, hey, let me show you way, but just a, as we live our life way, just examples of what does it look like to be lost in Christ, both in our suffering and our hardship and our sorrow and our loss, but in our joy and our community and our relationship. And I think that's a foreign concept to us. I think we live with the cross on the front end of the Christian life and Jesus's resurrection on the back end of the Christian life. And we live the middle part of the Christian life, just chugging away. And we forget that we're supposed to be dying and rising daily. And that adds a whole new dynamic to the Christian life.
Would you say that the first time that John and Esther, I want to say make love, not when they're in the car, but when they're on the couch, would you say that that is a redeeming moment, but not a redemption moment, maybe?
Not really. Okay. I mean, I know one of the reviewers said that. I didn't agree with him. I mean, she was broken and sorrowful, and he was, I mean, it was kind of, it was almost taking it. I mean, it was mutual consent, but I would almost say it as taking advantage of that moment of her brokenness. And like they definitely tried to make it tender, and they tried to make it more face instead of just oogling over the body. And that it was well acted, but this is where I go back to, I'm going to evaluate an addiction based on God's moral standards. And so if you're going to violate God's moral standards, I mean, you did it better than last time, but sorry, I still can't call that redemptive.
So even though it's in the film.
Well, he felt that way too, because he still got Hail Marys and whatever for that, and he was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, one of the funniest things, even though, I mean, hypothetically, I can understand why he would expect less Hail Marys and Our Fathers.
Right.
But at the same time, like, it's cool, because I wasn't looking at porn. I was still having sex outside of marriage.
Right.
So there was still a disconnect there that, well, this isn't that bad.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, which was where I would go back to, well, why did you confess it? Yeah. If you weren't expecting to, in the system you were in, get Hail Marys and Our Fathers.
Well, that is cool. Well, I mean, Lauren, how did you feel the movie kind of resolved for you?
Well, I'm kind of thinking about this phrase, losing yourself, and it's kind of a little misleading because why is he trying to lose himself? Because he wants actually more life. He wants to be more whole. He wants to be more, to feel more the things that he, the appetites that he feels are natural to him. Like he wants to be more connected to that. He doesn't want to escape necessarily. He doesn't want to not feel anything. He wants to feel something more complete, more whole. And so I feel like maybe for a time he's found that in Esther. There's definitely, I mean, the film, in some ways the film is very obvious about things, but I can't necessarily fault it for that because it works. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you see him when he's with Barbara, you keep seeing these cut scenes of him in his car, him in his apartment, him mm-hmm. in his church. And he gets more and more angry, and to the point of getting out of the car and in road rage, punching through this guy's window. And he is not talking to his friends anymore. He won't pick up the phone. He's actually becoming more and more angry and more of a recluse. And actually, just kind of like a clearest picture of that is that when Barbara finds his internet history, he doesn't know how to look up his history or how to delete it.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
come on.
And it shows him after that interaction, it shows him deleting his history every time. So he's actually hiding more and more.
That's good.
But then when he's interacting with Esther, she pulls no punches about the question she asks him about what he's doing. I mean, she catches him watching porn on his phone, and she just says it right out several times. Why are you watching people on your phone, you know? Mm-hmm. So she's not really interested in him hiding. She doesn't really have a lot to lose in that relationship, but she keeps asking him real questions and drawing his true self out of him. And so, anyway, all that to say that I feel like he's actually coming maybe more in touch with the real thing when he's with Esther than he was in any other way. But at the same time, I feel like at some point that is going to not be enough.
Yeah.
And he's going to discover that. Of course it looks better. I mean, a steak looks better than like a, you
not
know.
Steak.
than not. Anything else.
Not steak.
Tofu.
Yeah. I mean, but it's still not the ultimate source. And so it's eventually going to run out. So it's a temporary fix for the problem.
And he does say at the end, we're not even talking about marriage yet. Like he goes, that's just editing wise. It's amazing how much of the movie was his voice narrating scenes. It's kind of a unique feature of the movie. But anyway, at the end he says, sometimes we just talked and it shoots them talking in the park. Sometimes we had amazing sex. And then sometimes, but we're not even talking about marriage yet, which made it sound like, I think he said she's not ready to do that. Which we haven't talked about like her whole experience of the death of her husband and son is a big experience of losing herself or losing something that's a big part of her. So I think it speaks to that. And I think he kind of had to end that way. Like if he'd ended and then we got married and lived happily ever after and had a Christian wedding and in a beautiful church, like it would have just been completely written off. So I think he maybe went as far as he could go and still have authenticity and credibility, culturally speaking. But I agree with you that, I mean, hopefully he would eventually see that there's more to it than just having a person instead of a website.
And I think I'm actually kind of okay with it ending there, because one thing I was thinking of is that there are a lot of seems like when films come out that are actually advertised as Christian films,
right?
The message is so beat you over the head obvious that it's not even really nuanced enough to be interesting. It doesn't really draw up any questions that you hadn't really thought about before.
Right.
And also, it puts a lot of people off. So your audience is already pretty small because of the audience, or because of the, I just totally lost my train of thought there. But this film is asking a lot of the same questions that I feel like, say, a Christian film on the subject would want to ask, mm-hmm. but it's going to reach a much broader audience because mm-hmm. it's willing to be shocking. It's willing mm-hmm. to, it's willing to not necessarily give a lot of answers, but just ask a lot of questions. So
I have to tell a quick funny story about that. So Brandy's in a salon getting her a hair shop. She's getting her hair cut, and two of the ladies at another booth are talking about this movie. And one of the ladies says, I went to this movie thinking it would be this great romantic comedy, but I was so disgusted. Like, it just showed it completely showed from Barbara Sugarman's perspective what a person was hoping to see when they went to see that movie, but then, definitely didn't see what they wanted to see. So, I go back to what I said at the beginning. He spoke with somewhat of a prophetic voice, I thought. Like, I admire him for tackling this topic. And he used, in one of his interviews, he talked about substantial subject matters. The best way to talk about substantial subject matters is often with humor.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just has, like you said, Mikey, he threaded the needle very well of a difficult subject using humor, hitting a wide audience.
Yeah. Not slapstick.
Not slapstick.
Yeah, not like a lot of American type comedies where it's like just shocking to be shocking.
Yeah.
But well, great. I want to kind of shift things now to what we do at the end of every show. So kind of talking about like our come on kind of moments, our get real. What was up with that? An otherwise great film. So where did you land on that, Elijah?
Come on moments. I have a hard time thinking of one because the film was so... It was so over the top mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. Like everything was guy talk to the max. It was, but probably I would choose just a simple one. Her name, Barbara Sugarman. I was like, oh, that's great. Barbara Sugarman, come on. And I mean, she did a great job. Scarlett Johansson did, but she was almost like this giddy two shoes character, but then this self-absorbed character, and then this really no different than all the other girls' characters. So I guess her name and maybe a little bit of, which is how he wanted to portray her, obviously. Yeah, kind of a deep ditz, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess if I had to say something, there was definitely one point in the movie where I thought, oh, they obviously want me to feel this, or they obviously want me to see this. And I don't know if I can necessarily fault them for that, because they weren't trying to be cryptic in the beginning. But just the fact that, like, that after he met Esther and he was really connecting with Esther, now he's, like, singing in his car. He doesn't have any road rage anymore, you know. And he's suddenly able to see things more clearly, everything more clearly, and everything is like sunshine and birds. And anyway, it was all that whole transition, or the contrast rather, between him with Barbara and him with Esther was so obvious.
Right.
That it did kind of feel like, oh, well, now everything's good. Like, this is what life is about. This is what makes life happy.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'd say actually that's more or less, in a different way that I'd phrase it, my problem or my gripe, I guess, with the movie. I feel like addiction isn't easy. If it's a true addiction, like we talked earlier in the show, addiction isn't easy to overcome. This is actually where, even though I would really caution people against watching Shame, it is incredibly well done. And I think it shows a more accurate and, to a certain degree, hopeless picture of what deep addiction looks like. The level of addiction that we're led to believe that John has for pornography, it's really hard for me to believe that he's going to be you know, looking at pornography 34 times this week, and then the next week he's just done.
Yeah, just can walk away from
like,
his computer.
It's complete. You know, it's like a switch. You know,
right.
And I know that we would even argue that, you know, once you're shown life, you would obviously want to strive for true life better. But the whole concept of Christianity, the whole concept of the gospel, is that even though you know it's better and you're going to strive for something better, you're still not better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're still trying. Mm-hmm. You're running a race. You don't instantly finish the race.
Right.
And so to me, it seemed a little too convenient that he makes this connection, and then like all his problems are solved.
Right.
Even though, you know, his life isn't perfect, it's still a little too convenient. So, so we move from kind of that moment to our best moment or scene or whatever in the movie.
Mine was when I think he was doing pull-ups in the gym and he's doing Our Father, and Barbara Sugarman's character walks up and says, "What are you doing? You're talking to yourself?" And then he just kind of plays it off like, no, I'm not doing anything. And he's really just going through his routine of working out and doing his Our Fathers. That's a good, funny moment for me.
It was hard for me too. I guess maybe a moment that keeps coming back to me is when he was going into the gym to do his normal routine, and he just decides to hang right and go play basketball with these guys, which he, you know, his workout has always been always self-focused, always about his body, watching himself in the mirror, you know, get more buff or whatever. And now he's just playing a pickup game with some strangers. And I just like that picture of finding something that's bigger than yourself so that you're capable of entering the whole, entering the community and being a part. And for that to even be something that, I mean, he walked past, I think those doors were open and people were playing basketball in there every time he walked past, like throughout the beginning of the movie. And this is the only time that he even noticed they were there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in some ways, maybe for the same reason, the couch sex scene, just because it was the first time that he looked somebody in the eyes while doing something intimate. So it was cool to see that, to see him beginning to connect with other people. I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think my favorite moment was kind of a scene, and it was the scene where he has the coffee conversation with Barbara towards the end. And I've been trying to figure out why I liked it so much, and I still can't necessarily put my finger on it. But I guess in explaining it, what I saw was him finally being honest and not being ashamed of the ways that he was imperfect, and then not having to put or bring someone else down because of what his problems were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think after that scene, it was obvious that Barbara still had a problem.
Right.
And at least, even if John wasn't perfect, he was working on his, he was aware of his. And it just kind of looked like, you know, a recovering addict talking to an addict, except basically not being like, well, you've got a problem. Because the first time they have this very similar conversation is when he's in denial, you know, or when he goes, well, you're just as bad as I am. Which, I mean, which is true. But in this one, you know, he's like, he doesn't even bother talking about her. It's not about her anymore. It's about him. You know, he can't fix her. He can only fix him.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that he just said, you know, for my part, I'm sorry.
Right.
And she's like, well, what do you want? He wants to get back together, you know?
Yeah,
and
she,
he's like, no. I mean, he's not trying to get back together with her. He's just being like, hey.
She really wanted him to grovel and then to be able to say no.
But she just wanted to rub in his face some more. And he didn't give her. I mean, it was almost better for him to have done that than to say, well, at least I'm not addicted to this life that ain't happening. At least I can clean my own house.
Right.
You know, which is gratifying as that seems like it would have been. I mean, you know, he seemed to take the high road. And I think that's a conversation that you don't often see people have.
Yeah.
Because most conversations like that are justification to the other person.
Right.
Or bringing the other person down to your level. And it was, it wasn't about that. So I just really enjoyed that scene. But, I guess with that, we wind it down. So I really appreciate you guys for watching this movie, for, you know, putting yourself out there, talking about this tough stuff.
Can we, like, tune out to Eminem's Lose Yourself?
No, we can't. I think I have to pay royalties for that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, I'm not sure.
You can sing it. You can sing, like, 5 seconds of it.
Gotta lose yourself in the moment you want it. You better never let it go. You only got one shot. Do not lose your chance.
You know way more of the song than I thought you did.
I used to be a rapper in my previous life.
Right.
When you were at the inner city church in South Florida.
Yeah.
Keeping it real.
Yeah.
Awesome.
One day people will see what Elijah looks like and realize, well, we're laughing. lots of offense. But, okay, so I want to give you guys a chance to kind of, you know, if people have enjoyed what you've said or they want to continue a conversation with you or just thank you for being able to talk about something that's not exactly easy or, yeah, well, let's just say easy for most, I guess, Christians or any kind of theological discussion about sexual themes and stuff like that. And they want to continue that. They want to get a hold of you. They want to talk to you. How would they do that, Elijah?
You can reach me at Church the Redeemer. I'm the executive and community pastor there. My email is Elijah@RedeemerGSO.org.
They can't find you. Wait, we have a website, don't we?
We have a website, www.RedeemerGSO.org. And yeah, you can listen to other podcasts on Mikey's site or listen to sermons on our website if you want to.
Cool. Laura?
I am on Twitter, and my handle, I just looked it up, is @Laura_Pissel. Also, I just finished my first full-length novel, so I'm going to probably start posting on my blog again, which is leavingteaching.blogspot.com. But the thing that I'm probably working on the most diligently out of anything is I'm writing a Whoology segment on Mikey's Real World Theology website. So I just posted my second one on episode 2.
On the day of this recording. Though people probably won't hear this till next week.
Oh, well, yeah.
But that's fine. Heck, maybe there's another Whoology by then.
And yes, any agents or publishers or editors listening, please contact me immediately.
Well, and hopefully... Hopefully Elijah will also be one of those contributors sooner than later.
Hopefully.
As soon as he doesn't have...
If I get off my procrastination stool.
Well, as soon as you don't have an executive and community high role to perform.
Yeah.
But and if you miss any of that stuff will be in the show notes. I'll make sure I post all that on the site so people can get a hold of you guys. Thanks once again for coming and being here. It really means a lot to me. So if you want to interact with me, though, or let me know of movies you'd love to hear us discuss on the show, then feel free to follow me on Twitter at the new Real World Theology Twitter account, @RealWorldTheo.
Is it really new?
It is. Okay. I just created it like a week ago.
Okay.
I was using my own personal account, which is @Fizzification, which is another great Twitter handle. If you want to follow it, you can. But for the show specifically, you can follow Real World Theo. You can also find us at our blog, where I will have all the show notes, the blogs, the links, the websites that we use for research to talk about the movies. Also links to our guests and to the podcast itself at realworldtheology.com. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you do find us on iTunes, review the show, bump our rankings, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. I do want to leave us with one quote from Joseph Gordon-Levitt, because lots of people ask me, why do this? And I know I've asked Elijah this question on the podcast before, I think one of the first podcasts, but I think the fact that Joseph Gordon-Levitt kind of spells this out so succinctly shows why we do this and why we think it's important. So he says in an interview, "But I think that it's worth recognizing that the media that we all choose to consume, that actually does make a difference. That it is us participating in a larger cultural conversation. You know, I think we all sometimes like to think of whatever we watch as, it doesn't matter what I watch. It's all just harmless entertainment. And it's not entirely true, especially if you watch it repeatedly. I think that the stuff we watch does matter, and it does work its way into the way that we see the world." So thank you, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, for proving our existence. So again, I just want to thank my guests for being here and you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember, even if you don't believe me, believe Joseph Gordon-Levitt, that story is powerful and that entertainment is not mindless.
Bye-bye.
Bye.